This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. If you have a question about your animal's behavior, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls, we have another special topic to share. And what have you got for us today, Patricia?
Are you up for learning a new word?
Sure. What's that?
It's parthenogenesis.
Parthenogenesis. What in the heck is that?
It is the ability to self-fertilize. And a Komodo dragon named Flora, by the way, made headlines when she became the first Komodo dragon to be able to do this. So we're going to talk about how common parthenogenesis is, surprisingly common, as a matter of fact, and why it's necessary for some species to survive.
Are the guys going to like this?
I don't. That's up to you. That's your call, Larry.
Well, okay. We'll find out. And a little later on, we'll hear from an author and wildlife biologist who trekked across the Arctic, walked with his wife to find out what it means to be caribou. And before we get to that, we have some callers waiting to talk to us. So let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Leah from Shreveport, Louisiana.
Hello, Leah. Thank you for calling.
I have approximately 10-month-old Catahoula something mix.
Okay.
And we got her right around Christmas from the local shelter. So we haven't had her too long. And she likes to dig in the flower beds.
Oh, yeah.
Not the yard.
Okay.
Just the flower beds
okay.
where I have the nice plants we put in.
Of course.
And then she'll like to stand up and look in the windows, like kind of jump up on the windowsill. I mean, not on it, but put her feet up on it and look in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we just painted the house last summer, so we don't really want that. And we have tried copious amounts of red cayenne pepper, you know, ground pepper that you put out thinking, mate, you know, but she's a Catahoula. She's a southern dog. She likes hot things, apparently.
So
spicy it hasn't
things.
Really affected her.
Well, there are two things. Let me ask you one about the jumping on the windows.
Okay.
Sounds like there's the digging in the flower beds, so there's jumping on the windows.
Right.
And what I would do is I would teach her that there is a way to get yourself let back inside the house, and that's to sit at the door. And so that's what I do, rather than trying to find some way to correct her, although you might want to try black pepper. We had a caller years ago who suggested that for cats
and
on cars, and it worked great. Black pepper is a little more likely to get up into her nose and make her sneezy. So that's one possibility. You could also get, if you can use this outside, there's something called a scat mat. It delivers like a little carpet shock. And it's a plastic mat. And so if there's a place you can plug that in and put it outside, you might be able to use that too. But, you know, a Catahoula might not even notice it, frankly. So I think you're best teaching what you do want rather than worrying too much about what you don't want. So if what you want to do is teach her, if you come to the door and sit, then we will open the door. So first you manage the entire thing. You go outside, you have some treats, you teach her to sit right at the door, sit, and then a little stay, hold your hand out like a traffic cop, and then just count 1, 2, and then say, good girl, open the door. And opening the door is her reward for sitting. The digging in the flower bed is very, very, very common. Dogs love to dig, but they're not stupid. They like to dig where it's easy and fun to dig, just like we do. Where do you want to dig? In hard-packed clay or a nice, loamy, beautiful? You know, they want to dig where we want to dig. So your flower beds have been nicely prepared for your dog. So that's part of what's going on there. And so in that case, you want to, for a while, until she gets used to the yard, I would create a physical barrier. I would put some kind of attractive fencing that's high enough that she can't jump over it, give her lots of things to do in the rest of the yard. You might want to take a hollow toy and put some food in it and give that to her when she's outside and only when she's outside. So that's one possibility. But for now, you're best off by just preventing the problem, getting the right habit established. That
makes
helps.
Good sense. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call for you to join in. Tricia, we received an email from Emily in De Pere, Wisconsin, and she has a question about her two cats, and she writes the following. I'm moving 1,000 miles away in a few months. How does one drive 1,000 miles with two cats without wanting to throw them or oneself out the window? I'm worried about trying to sedate them because it's a 20-hour drive. Very long time to be sedated. I'm not sure if they'll do well in the car. I've planned to drive straight through because I think stopping at a hotel would be disorienting for them. Are there any other options besides sedation? Is there even a way to sedate them for 20 hours, for gosh sakes? Or should I just grit my teeth and hope for the best?
The question is, do you want to tranquilize them or do you want to sedate them? You know, you don't necessarily have to have them sound asleep. And their medications, like what we call Valium, mm-hmm. for example, that depending on how much you give them, can just make them feel good or can make them very, very sleepy. And so that's a question I would ask your veterinarian. But as a certified behaviorist, what I would suggest to you is you might want to work your way up a little bit into getting them used to being in the car where they learn that they're not necessarily going to the veterinarian or maybe this isn't such a bad thing. So first of all, think about the crate you're going to use. Get a crate. If they do well together, then you might do best to put them in together so you get a larger crate. One of the things that's really helpful to know about cats in crates is the easiest way to get a cat in a crate is to put it in vertically. So if you have a mm-hmm. crate that has a side entrance, tip the crate up so you can hold the cat up and just sort of descend
drop
them,
it.
Drop them. I mean,
well,
not drop as in let gravity take over completely, but you can have gravity help you. It's much easier to get a cat in a crate that way. Larry is nodding.
I am nodding my head.
After I told Larry about
vigorously.
That. And after I learned that, it was like, oh, yeah, this is way easier. So that's one thing that's helpful to know. So, you know, you might want to get the cats used to being in the crate. If it's big enough, you might want to just leave it in the house with no door. Just take the door off and have maybe something really extra warm in there. Maybe have treats in there. Create a little place where they choose to go on their own. So one is about getting them used to the enclosure. And you definitely want them crated in the car. It's very dangerous.
Yes.
I see people not do this, and it's really dangerous. You open the door at a toll booth because you dropped a quarter and your cat's out and gone. So they must be crated to be safe when they're in the car. So get them used to the crate, and then there's a second issue of getting them used to driving around. So that's something you can also do step by step where you just go around a little block and then let them out a little longer, a little longer. The one thing I would want you to think about this 20-hour trip is how are they going to get out to go to the bathroom? So it actually might be better for them to have an overnight. It might be safer for you driving, just in terms of your alertness.
20 hours straight through.
That's a long time to drive.
Even professional drivers do not do that.
I'm not sure that's legal for truck drivers. I don't know.
It's not.
Larry knows. See, Larry knows everything. He knows everything. Anyway, I would reconsider. I would suggest an overnight. The cats are going to need to potty. They're going to want to eat, sort of relax and calm down, give yourself a rest.
Halfway through. And if you have a question and you'd like to email it, you can do that.
You can. We love to get your questions and your ideas. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Rick in Humboldt County, California.
Well, Rick, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, you see, I've got this little terrier. She's Xena the Terrier Princess. You may have heard of Xena the Warrior Princess, but she can be kind of warrior-like when she's tugging at your ankles. But the problem is she's pretty spoiled, and she sleeps with us, and she wants to get up a few times during the night sometimes and eat grass. And so a couple of times what I do, I go out and I cut her a big bowl of grass, and she'll sit there and chow down on it like a sheep or something, and then she doesn't get me up, but that's kind of a hassle. So
let me get this straight. You're a guy who will get up in the middle of the night and go out and cut grass for this little dog so she can chow down. Do you have a partner who is aware of how incredibly lucky she is?
She is. We're both kind
guy.
Of we're pretty amazing with our dog, I got to say.
She's, yeah, what a
everyone
guy.
People stop on the street and approach us cuz she's so cute. I mean, you can't say no to this dog.
How did you find out that she wanted grass?
Well, she'd get out there and just start eating it, and, you know, she'd do, sometimes it's, you know, it's not that often, once every couple of weeks or something, and she wants to go out there two or three times a night, so.
This brings up a very interesting question, which no one knows the answer to, which is why do dogs eat grass? There's actually, I was told, I don't know this directly, but through the grapevine, I was told somebody tried to answer this question for a PhD and never found anything even close to an answer.
Oh.
What she found is it didn't correlate with parasite load, and that's one of the possibilities, because we know there are many animals, there are many wild animals, primates are famous for this, who selectively eat different types of vegetation as a way of purging internal parasites.
Yeah.
So that's always been one idea. The other is that they needed more fiber. And that certainly seems like a reasonable possibility.
Sure.
So the one thing I'm curious about is you mentioned this isn't every night. You said this is cyclical.
Right.
So every couple of weeks she has this great desire.
Yep. And then she'll, barf up a little bit. And she, I put vegetables in her food pretty often, cooked ones.
Yeah, but, good for you. Well, yeah. I'll tell you, I would make sure there wasn't anything medically wrong with her. I mean, this is a great question for your veterinarian, but
yeah.
If she did it every night, I would say, well, she's trained you to get up in the middle of the night and take
right.
her outside.
Yeah,
certainly she doesn't have to have grass. So one possibility, just in terms of what do you do about it,
yeah.
one possibility is you just sleep through the night. You just say, I'm sorry, honey, not tonight. I've got a headache, and just and just go back to sleep. But it would get me wondering what's going on with her. I would look for the possibility of some kind of parasite. And I would think about adding a little bit more fiber. You might want to think about pumpkin or squash is often a great source of fiber for some individuals. You might want to look at the kind of food you're feeding her. There are tons of really great dog foods out there now.
Yeah, we give her real expensive food.
Yeah, bless your heart.
Good for you.
She's spoiled all the way around, although I don't think spoiled. You know, it's not like she's ruined. She's just well cared for here.
Yeah, and she goes to the vet regularly, so.
Does she seem healthy in
she's
every
super,
other way?
Super healthy, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it then. I would pursue some of those things I talked about.
Okay.
But otherwise, I would roll over, put the pillow over my head and say, go back to sleep, honey.
She might just like the process of you getting up.
But why does she do it every – why is it cyclical, Larry?
I have no idea.
See, that makes me think it is something about her stomach is there's something uncomfortable. She's in some kind of minor intestinal distress.
I have another question. Did the woman who tried to prove or find out about grass-eating dogs actually get her PhD?
The story is she did not.
Yeah, I wondered
about that.
Because
she found nothing.
I wondered.
Negative results totally and completely do not get you a PhD.
Rick, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number for you to call. Coming up next, we'll get a vocabulary lesson from Patricia and find out just what parthenogenesis is and why it's so important for some species to survive. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Time for this week's topic. And, Tricia, we saw an interesting story in the news recently about a very special Komodo dragon.
Yes, a Komodo dragon named Flora, by the way, made headlines when she laid 7 eggs without ever having been on a date, so to speak.
Oh, no. Well, I think most of us have heard of Komodo dragons, but what can you tell us about them? Give us a little background.
Well, sure. You know, as I think we all know, they're large lizards, almost prehistoric looking, and they're really big. As adults, they can weigh up to 300 pounds. They're predatory, carnivorous. They can eat animals as large as an adult pig or a deer in one sitting.
Whoa.
These are big creatures. They're native to the islands of Indonesia, and they were first found, not surprisingly, on the island of Komodo.
Komodo. And
thus, the Komodo dragon.
And now, apparently, they don't need a mate if they want to procreate. Is this common in the animal kingdom?
You know, it is. We don't think about it much because it's not that common in mammals. But this ability to self-fertilize, for females to be able to fertilize themselves, is called parthenogenesis. And it's quite common. It's quite common in insects, honeybee, for example, we all know the honeybee.
Yeah.
If something happens to the queen bee, who normally does mate with males during these mating flights, but if something happens to her, the female worker bees can lay eggs themselves, never having mated with a male.
Hmm.
Now, all the bees that are born will be males. They'll all be drones.
Okay.
But nonetheless, they don't have to mate to make baby bees. This is quite common in reptiles and amphibians. There's a group of lizards in the American Southwest, very common. They're called the whiptail lizards. They're famous for being able to do this.
And what about the Komodo dragons? Does this happen a lot for them? Or
We don't know.
Oh.
It's the first occurrence that we know of in Komodo dragons. And this is particularly important because the Komodo species is endangered. It's estimated there are only 4,000 individuals left in the wild. And of those, only about 1,000 of them are females.
So why do some animals end up reproducing without a mate?
Well, you know, it's a really good question. We don't know quite how animals have developed this ability. But we do know that the ability to reproduce without a male could be important for animals who live in stable environments and in dispersed populations. You know, Komodo dragons live on islands. There are not very many of them. So you never know if there's going to be a male around or not. You know, sexual reproduction, the ability to reproduce with a male is advantageous because it creates variety, and variety is helpful in a changing environment. But there's a lot of cost to sexual reproduction. But asexual reproduction is probably advantageous if an animal lives in a stable environment where it's hard to find a mate, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I can speak on behalf of the men listening
today. Are you feeling a little threatened, Mueller?
We're happy it has not occurred in humans.
Well, may I say, speaking as a representative of my half of the female population, I'm happy too.
Well, that's good.
I'd rather prefer it the way we have it ourselves.
And if you would prefer to call us, here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Wayne calling from Boise, Idaho.
Wayne, thank you very much for calling. How can we help?
Well, I've got a kitten, and he's about 6 months old. We got him for our daughter, Kira, through a foster cat adoption program.
Well, good for you.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a really very adorable cat, and one of the things that's most adorable about him is that he likes to suck on people's ears. He just kind of attaches himself to an earlobe and will sit there and suck and purr and knead and do all those things, and then when he's done, he goes away. But he's obsessive about it, and, you know, he even gets to the point where if you pull him away, you know, he'll meow at you. Meow, meow,
ooh,
I really want that ear.
It is obsessive.
Yeah, so he's adorable, but he's also obsessive. And I guess that's okay. That's why we like him. But I guess the question are there any long-term implications of doing that? You know, should we encourage him not to do it? I mean, I don't think we really mind. My daughter absolutely loves it. You know, she'll come home from school and pick him up, and off he goes. What's the long term on that?
Well, it's a good question to ask because, especially given your description that when you pull the kitten away, he starts meowing. Oh, please! He starts meowing as if he's distressed and really wants it back. There's a kind of an obsessive component to this kind of behavior. You know, a lot of habits change your physiology, and sometimes that physiology changes the neurotransmitters, changes your biochemistry, such that animals become compelled to do something, and they become literally obsessive about it. And if they don't get it, they become extremely distressed. And I'm a little worried that this kitten could be on the road to that. So I would discourage it. I think your biggest behavioral challenge will be your daughter. I don't think it'll be the kitten. I would encourage your daughter to redirect the kitten to doing something else. I wouldn't necessarily try and make the kitten go cold turkey necessarily. But after it's happened a little bit, what you might want to do is try and get it interested in other objects. It's probably, by the way, it well might be a kitten who didn't get a normal development. It's not always true. Sometimes you see it in animals who had a perfectly normal development, but There are some animals who didn't get nurtured enough, didn't get enough suckling, didn't get enough attention from their mother. Perhaps their mother died or wasn't an attentive kind of mother. And you find them doing a lot of that sucking and kneading. It's exactly the motions that very young infantile puppies and kittens do. So what I would do is let the kitten do a little bit of that, and then I would redirect it, find something it really likes, even if you have to smear a little bit of oil or, you know, tuna oil or a little bit of chicken flavor or something on a toy to redirect the kitten. So I wouldn't go cold turkey. It's not a crisis unless it starts to become compulsive, and I'm a little worried that
It could. Thank you very much for calling. And here's the number for you to call, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Tracy. I'm from West Fork, Arkansas.
Tracy, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a dog, Bill. He is about 6 years old. He's a Jack Russell Terrier. And we've recently moved. Bill used to live on a quiet dead-end street where he was one of two dogs. He was king and she was queen. Everybody wanted a visit from Bill.
Yeah.
And now we live on a very busy corner, and the yard is not fenced. So the only time he's allowed out is on his leash. He doesn't have his area that he feels like he can guard, I think. And anytime we have motorcycles, we also there's a train track near here, Bill goes berserk.
Oh, dear.
He barks and goes crazy. He just gets overexcited, and I don't know how to make him do anything else.
Okay.
I can recognize the behavior. He gets, you know, I see it occurring, but I don't know how to...
What to do about it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I do have some ideas for you. It's not a quick fix. It's going to take a while. But
right.
But you definitely can have effect on this behavior. Hopefully you like training because you're going to need to be doing some. You can make it really fun for him and for you both. What I want you to do is start with what trainers call a default behavior, just something that he sort of always can do no matter what's going on, that he can do almost without thinking. And in this case, I would teach him watch me. So what I want you to do, nothing else is going on. There's no noise. It's quiet. You've got little pieces of something he loves more than anything in the world. Or you have a tennis ball. Does he like balls and toys?
He loves balls and
all
toys.
All right. So you can use both food and balls and toys. And what I want you to do is wait till it's really quiet. He just happens to have his head turned around another way. He's looking away from you. And I want you to say, watch me. And hopefully, just by hearing that, he'll turn his head around. As he's turning his head, the timing is critical here. You say, good boy, and you throw the ball or you toss him a treat. If his head doesn't turn, if you say, watch me, and your words float into the air, having had no effect on him whatsoever, you use what's called a prompt. You do something that helps him turn his head. You go, or you make a little noise. You tap your fingers on the counter. You do something that gets his head to turn to you.
Okay.
And then you can reinforce them right away. So you work on that really hard, like for a week, so that you say, watch me, and bang, that little terrier just whips around. And terriers are great at this. They're like, yes, what have you got for me?
What have you got for me?
What have you got? And then what you're going to start doing is teaching him watch me in the presence of a distraction. Don't do it with a train track yet. That's graduation. That's the triple Lutz jump in the Olympics. You know, you're working on skating backwards now, right?
Yes, I think that's where we've been going all wrong.
You've been going too far too fast?
Yes, is trying to modify the behavior when it is occurring.
That's where, like
you suggested, at the downtime.
That's where everybody goes wrong. So you're in a huge, good group. All human species.
Everybody does that.
We all do this. And me, there are times I have to stop myself from doing it. You're absolutely right. You can't get him to do something that's very difficult for him in the middle of the problem behavior. Teach it away from the problem. It probably is going to, it might take you 2 months to work your way up to asking him to watch me when a train starts to go by. And if he does, you're going to give him a jackpot. You're going to give him 15 treats. You're going to give him the whole chicken. Like, here, have the chicken. No, no bones. Just here, here's the whole. Just flood him with abundance. So he's like, wow, that was really great. So that's one thing to do. It also sounds like, in general, this is a very stimulating, overstimulating environment. You might even want to think about DAP, D-A-P, dog appeasing pheromone. It's a pheromone that tends to relax some dogs. It's the easiest behavior modification in the world. If it works, you buy it, you plug it in. We can all do that. So give that a try, too.
And thanks
okay,
a lot
great.
For calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Coming up next, we'll talk with an author and wildlife biologist who followed 123,000 caribou along their five-month migration across the Arctic wilderness. We'll hear his story after this short break. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week we welcome Karsten Heuer to the program. Karsten is a wildlife biologist and the author of the book Being Caribou. It details his and his wife's five-month trek along the trails of the porcupine caribou herd migration. And he joins us today to talk about it. Karsten Heuer, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
You followed the porcupine herd of caribou for several months as they migrated across Alaska and parts of Canada. That was a long ways, 1,000 miles, something like that. Why did you decide to embark on this journey?
Well, it all started when I was working up in the northwest corner of the Yukon, so just on the Canadian side. It's called a Vavik that borders onto the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. And I experienced this caribou herd migrating past us on my very first trip into the park. You know, this is not something like a couple of deer passing in front of your car on the way to work. Hmm. This was something that went on for 2 days and two nights. And you know, having grown up in a fairly major city up in Canada, I was just blown away by this. As you know, eagles were soaring overhead, bears were waiting in the willows as the herd walked by. Wolves were flanking it on either side, foxes and some other birds, the hawks, they were flitting in and out of the herd, you know, feeding on the mice and the voles that were being scared up by the hooves. And when finally the last few individuals passed and disappeared over the next ridge, there was a huge part of me that just, you know, and sort of very heartfelt part that just wanted to abandon everything I had to do and all my obligations as a park ranger. And just to follow them, drop everything and go over that ridge and see what they were doing and what they were up to. And so there was that very sort of pure motivation. And then when I got back from that shift back to the office, because it's a fly-in and fly-out park, you know, I was really intrigued by who these animals were and what they were doing. And I started to do some research, and it turned out where they were headed was their calving grounds in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge on the Alaskan side, and it also turned out there'd been this decades-old debate going on whether to develop those calving grounds for oil and gas reserves known to exist underneath, or whether to leave them as is and fully protect them. And so this trip, this journey, was really an attempt to tell the caribou side of the story, which I didn't really read anywhere. You know, we always talk about issues like this in terms of, you know, millions of dollars to be made, or, you know, tens of thousands or even millions of barrels of oil to be extracted, and not really in any terms that the caribou could comprehend. And so my wife and I started thinking, well, what is the value of this place from their perspective? And we decided it's in everything they go through, all the trials, all the tests of endurance, all the wolf chases, the blizzards, the river crossings, to get to those calving grounds and then back to the winter range. And so we decided we were going to do that with them and tell that story.
What did it mean to be caribou?
Well, I mean, that's a hard question to answer in a in you know, a few seconds or a few minutes. But, you know, when we left on the journey, I thought it really meant to simply follow in their footsteps and go through everything that they did at a physical level. And certainly we did that. But I think doing that also sort of broke down our ways of being human, and I mean our modern ways of being human, which is, you know, sort of carry around all this noise and sort of mental clutter in our minds and always be thinking about the future and what we have to do and being so goal-oriented and objective-oriented at the expense of really seeing, hearing, and feeling what's happening around us right now. And what developed, you know, we sort of sloughed off all those old ways of being human. And what came behind it was this incredible openness, this incredible calmness, and even contentedness, and also this incredible acuity of the senses, which only increased as the trip went on, and I think really only become available to us when we immerse ourselves in wild places devoid of the sound of machinery and cell phones and all the other distractions that bother us in everyday life. Our dreams also started to be influenced by the herd to the extent that we started to have these dreams from the calving grounds onward back to their winter range, which, again, predicted the future, predicted scenes that would transpire minutes or hours or even days after we'd had them. And so we also tapped into, you know, this whole idea, I guess, of being able to follow your dreams in a very literal sense of them guiding us. It was as if the very boundaries of between, you know, the sleeping the waking world and the dream world, between future, past, and present, all dissolved, and we entered this other sort of consciousness, this other sphere of being that has made everything else kind of seem shallow in comparison.
And your, if I read your book correctly, your experience, you did get to the calving grounds, which are in the Arctic, the National Wildlife Refuge. And would you tell us about your experiences there that suggested to you that it would truly be problematic for the herd if there was some kind of human development in that area?
Sure. And just let me sort of paint a little bit of a scene of what this place is. It's called the Coastal Plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and it's sort of wedged between the Brooks Range, which is a very impressive chain of mountains, 8,000 feet high, you know, sort of just within a few dozen miles of the Arctic Ocean itself. So there's a tremendous amount of relief coming out of the land there, and then this sort of flat plain, almost prairie-like landscape at the foot of them that stretches right to the shore of the Arctic Ocean. And so we arrive on the calving grounds, and what we noticed immediately was how the caribou's behavior shifted, their behavior towards us. And they'd been relatively accepting of our presence during the spring migration, so long as we skied or walked 100 or 200 yards away. They didn't seem bothered by us, and they would just continue to feed and plod on themselves. As soon as we arrived on the calving grounds and each cow sort of started staking out a tiny piece of the tundra where it was going to sort of settle down and go through the final stages of labor and give birth, that tolerance evaporated, and they became incredibly skittish, protective of that place that they had staked out for themselves. To the extent that so even if Leanne and I sort of poked our head outside of the tent door, animals that were half a mile away would bolt. And this incredible sensitivity, you know, results in this situation where Leanne and I couldn't poke out a head or an arm or a foot or anything out of the tent for 10 straight days and 10 straight nights. And so this 4-foot by 6-foot fabric dome, you know, which demanded that we're hunched over constantly, became, up to then it had only been our bedroom, but suddenly for these 10 days as caribou started to birth all around us, it became our kitchen, our living room, and our bathroom as well.
So after you completed this amazing migration, you went to D.C. to talk about what you'd seen and about why you think the Arctic land should be protected. So what response did you get from the congressmen and the congresswomen that you spoke with on Capitol Hill?
Well, that sort of endeavor of virtually yanking ourselves from that situation and flew as directly as you can from Old Crow to Washington, D.C., which is, you know, seven flight changes at seven increasingly busy airports, and then landed in this place so different, and yet our spirits didn't make the adjustment, obviously. And then to kind of go from door to door, you know, in the halls of Congress and the Senate, and try to tell this story, this amazing story that did spill over into the spiritual, into the 5 minutes, you know, we were afforded in various meetings with various congressmen and senators, first of all, was extremely difficult. And you know, a lot of them, I think, really did try to understand what we'd been through, and we'd brought photos in, and we told our story. And quite a few of them, you know, who already have been champions of the Arctic Refuge for quite some time, you know, really appreciated it in that it strengthened their resolve to continue fighting in what up till now has been a very uphill battle to keep the drill rigs out of that special place. Mm-hmm. But we also encountered, you know, both the aides and the senators themselves who historically have voted for the oil and gas development. In the many times that this has come up, unfortunately, not gotten through so far. And you know, I kind of did appreciate their bluntness because they would listen to our story, and so far as I could tell, some of them were at least partly moved. But they were very sort of practical and rational about it all and said, listen, you guys, you know, this is all fine and dandy, but the reality is our constituents, you know, the people who vote us in and out of power, you know, whether it's in Illinois or Florida or any other place, what really matters in their lives isn't whether there's 100-some-odd thousand caribou up in the Arctic, but, you know, what the price at the pumps is when they pull up for gas. And I guess that was the real sort of turning point in Leanne's and my minds when we realized, you know, our role is not to be here. If these people are telling us that in power, then our role is not be here sharing the story with them, but rather being out there and talking and sharing the story with those very constituents who are communicating that sentiment to their elected representatives.
And that's what you've been up to since returning from your journey, is going to the people.
Very much so. And you know, the book, Being Caribou, is one tool. My wife, Leanne Allison, the whole time, you know, we were trying to keep up to these caribou through absolutely every situation. She was also filming them, and that film, also called Being Caribou, has been doing tremendously well. It's won awards at film festivals throughout North America. Just this fall, it won what they call a Gemini Award in Canada, which is the Canadian equivalent of your Emmy Awards in the U.S. And you know, there's over 10,000 copies of this film circulating sort of through this underground network of people, and we continue, you know, this is now three and a half years later, we continue to get notes on a daily basis from people scattered throughout all the country who have seen it in some, you know, church basement showing or community hall showing or living room showing, and have absolutely been moved, and they're so thankful that, you know, they have seen that this place is not, you know, a white, frozen landscape void of life, but in fact, you know, one of the most sort of fertile, fecund, and diverse places that we have left in North America. I mean, what we're really talking about is something on the scale of the bison on the prairies back in the early 1800s. I mean, that's what we still have in the Arctic. And like you mentioned, you know, the tragedy is that so few of us even realize it. And so this story and this expedition that we undertook and the film and book that came out of it have really been our attempt to show, remind, and tell people that this exists, and whether or not we continue to allow it to exist is a conscious decision on our part.
Carson, it's a real pleasure to talk with you today. Your book is fascinating, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Carson Huer is the author of Being Caribou, and he joined us today from his home in Canmore, Alberta, Canada. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win your very own copy of Being Caribou. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. So if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and four winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Being Caribou by Karsten Heuer. And here's today's question. You could say caribou were built to travel. Their large concave hooves work like snowshoes to help them move easily across winter snow, and they also act like paddles when it comes time to swim across bodies of water. Though caribou are rarely in a hurry, they can be fast runners. How fast can the average caribou run? And again, if you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413 and tune in next week to find out the answer to this week's question. For now, we're ready to take some more calls, so let's do that. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Allison from Virginia Beach.
Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Yes.
Thank you, Allison, for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I need some help with my two cats. I have one named Sam who is a rescue and is terribly skittish. He's about 3 years old. Approximately 10 months ago, I got a kitten named Putter who has since grown up and become a pretty rambunctious, I think pretty normal cat. Well, Sam doesn't seem to have the ability to stick up for himself, so Putter wants to play and is pretty aggressive like a young cat would be. Not terribly aggressive, nothing mean or nasty. And Sammy doesn't seem to want to be able to defend himself. And he's skittish with people, and he's also skittish with Putter. And we've tried using squirt bottles to discourage Putter from attacking Sammy, is what it almost seems like.
Yeah, what it seems to feel like from...
from
Sam's perspective,
yes.
Anyway, yeah.
Yes, and occasionally Sammy will swat Putter, but it's not enough to really have him stick up for himself. Can you give me any advice?
It's a tricky one. It really is. Don't you just wish you could give them a little weapon, you know?
Yes.
Just give them a little something, a little pep talk. It's like, you can do it, because that is the easiest way to get the issue solved.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so hard to do it as a third party. It's absolutely true. I think you're probably best off partly doing what you're doing is every single time you can, I want you to preempt it. So teach Putter, distract him, give some kind of a startle cue that just gets his attention. And you might want to put it on cue. So maybe give a little click, and every time you go, if Putter turns towards you, something wonderful happens. You throw his favorite toy. You give him a little treat. So basically, every time he starts to move towards Putter, you distract him, get him going 180 degrees, doing something else in another direction. Meanwhile, and here's the tricky part, you need to restrict the two of them. You need to separate the two of them when you can't be there to manage things. And so every single time your Putter directs towards Sam, I want you to do something to get Sam to Putter to turn around 180 degrees and go do something else. So you're constantly rechanneling that energy, constantly, just over and over and over again. And it's quite tiresome. So I want you to redirect Putter, give him something to do, eat a piece of chocolate for yourself, redirect Putter, give him something to do, give him food, toy, eat a piece of chocolate, whatever you need to do to reinforce yourself, because it takes some energy, I can tell you.
It does.
I speak from experience.
And soon you'll be 10 pounds heavier.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, you could add a few other things. You could go running with Pooter. You could teach him to run on a treadmill with you and tire him out in other ways. And obviously that's the other thing to do, is do everything you can to play with Pooter and entertain him in all other possible ways, obviously.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Patricia, we talked to Fred in Berryville, Arkansas, whose pygmy goats were getting into his dog's food. Well, we weren't quite sure how to help Fred, but luckily a number of listeners wrote in to give us some tips. We heard from Andrea in Ellensburg, Washington. We heard from Jennifer in Combined Locks, Wisconsin, and Katie in Palmer, Alaska, and all suggested installing a battery-operated dog door in the side of the barn. And we know that there are battery-operated cat doors that open when a cat wears a special receiver on
their
collar.
That's right.
Yeah. So our listeners wonder if there might be a similar invention for dogs, and that way the dog can come and go from the automatic feeder as he pleases, while the goats stay away and keep off the extra pounds. There is such a product, isn't there?
That's a really good idea. Yay, we have the best listeners. That's a great idea. You know, dairy cows, a lot of livestock actually have a little collar that they wear, and it actually, they go to their feeding station, and the feeding station reads what individual cow they are and gives them exactly the right amount of ration. I should have such a system. So when I go out to eat at restaurants, oh, I'm sorry, Tricia, you only get this much. Gotta eat your string beans too. But so these systems that I know of, they're not really species specific. They're more, it's about the size of the collar. And so you can get them for, if it's, I don't know if they make them for a large dog. I just don't know. But it's a great idea, and it's definitely worth pursuing. Goats are so smart, though. I can just imagine them. They'll tinker in the back of the barn, and they'll create this little collar and, you know, figure out a way to beat the system.
You know, there might be another way to do it. Andrea in Ellensburg wonders if someday an inventor will design an automatic pet door that recognizes nose prints.
There you go.
Then you wouldn't need the collar.
There you go.
Oh, thanks to everybody who emailed us. And Patricia, how do people do that?
Oh, it's easy, and we love to hear from you. Just send us an email. Send it to pets@wpr.org. What could be easier than that?
And here's the number for you to call in with your question, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Pete from Alexandria, Virginia.
Pete, thank you for calling.
Thanks. We have two great dogs, Monster and Cameron, and each has their own issues. But I guess for the sake of brevity, I'll stick with Cameron today. She's an 8-year-old female golden retriever with a really bad howling problem.
Mm.
Some people have told us it's separation anxiety, but, you know, I think maybe she just loves too much.
the dog who loved too much.
Yeah. What happens is she starts getting into this emotional state, and you can sort of see her breaking down into this full-fledged, uncontrollable howl. And she'll do this every night when I get back from work. She'll run downstairs and meet me at the garage door and start howling. And she'll even do it 4 or 5 times during the day with my wife, who's home all day. You know, you can leave the room for 5 minutes and come back and she'll howl, or maybe you get up for a drink in the middle of the night, and sometimes she'll start howling when you come back. And it's just, you know, it's nice to know that she loves you that much, but it kind of drives you crazy.
A little excessive. It would be like every time you see your partner, they leap up and grab a hold of you and can't stop. Oh, I'm so glad to see you, honey. I saw you 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So it's not separation anxiety. It sounds like just it might be as simple as a case of arousal. So every individual expresses arousal differently. You get emotionally excited about something, and some of us get very vocal. It sounds like your Cameron, sounds like your Golden has just gotten into a habit of being very talky. So what I would try with her, since it's when someone comes back, it's when you come home from work, it's when your wife re-enters the room, I would entrain a different behavior, basically. I would train an incompatible behavior. Does she like toys? Is she a Golden?
Well, that's the other thing. She's obsessive compulsive about her ball.
Well, she's a Golden. So
yeah. Well, it's kind of like a Border Collie.
Yeah, okay.
But, sometimes I can distract her. If I throw her ball or say, you know, find your ball, that'll distract her and she'll go off and do that. But sometimes I'll throw her the ball and she'll keep howling with the ball in her mouth.
Send us a tape of that. That should be send us the tape with the regular howl and the ball in mouth howl.
Okay.
That would be very interesting. But you know what you might want to do is then add food, because you can't howl while she's swallowing.
Okay.
So what you might want to do is teach a new greeting routine. Pretend you got a new dog. Pretend you never had her before. And say, you know what? We want to teach her to do some tricks. We want to teach her to sit, lie down, and then sit pretty, and then high five. Wouldn't that be fun?
Okay.
And I like the sit. I would do sit and down, particularly because they're somewhat soothing. You know, I wouldn't teach her spin. We don't want to buzz her up any more than she is. So sit, lie down, sit up, sit pretty, high five. Relatively soothing, quiet things to do. And then you can also go get your ball, go get your toy. But so you're going to come home with treats. When you come home from work, you've got a little bait bag. You've got great little wonderful extra high quality good treats.
Okay.
And you're going to walk in and you're going to go, Cameron, sit. Good girl. Treat. Cameron, lie down. Good girl. Treat. Cameron. And then teach her sit pretty. So teach her a little trick repertoire. So if you get her mind working so that she's too busy to howl and her mouth has been doing other things, because when she's learning to do these things, she gets a treat, you might just get her out of it.
Okay. The slight problem is that she's already howling by the time I get in the door, but I think maybe if I had the treat, that would distract her. We'll try that.
Yeah. I would hopefully it'll sort of go backwards, but don't worry about the pre-howl as much as the post-howl in the beginning anyway.
Thanks a lot for calling. You know, I learned a lot today. I learned about being caribou. I learned about parthenogenic Komodo dragons. You know, Dave Barry would say that's a great name for a rock
band. For a band, right?
The parthenogenic Komodo dragons.
Well, who knows what rock band we'll name next week, Larry?
Thanks a lot, Patricia. Appreciate it. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster, and Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1229P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.